All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship. Rebound if necessary. Have you got power? One of these is off. Okay, all right. I just noticed the light was off here. So, all right, we are ready to move on here with verse 11. I again saw that under the sun that the race is not to the swift, not to the fastest person. They don't always get the gold medal. The battle is not to the most experienced warrior, is the idea of it, the one who has fought many times, who is able to deal with warfare and has proven himself to be successful. Neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor or success in this context maybe to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. Here the conjunction key is used to explain this, that time here is the same word we have seen used repeatedly in this book, F-E-T-H, apostrophe E-T-H. That means time or appointed time. In this case, it's kind of a neutral term. And chance, the masculine singular noun of pegah, P-E-G-A apostrophe. Two times this word is used. It's a neutral term that really means an incident or an event. There is no sense of fate or unexplained. They translate it here by the term chance, but it just means something which happens, something which occurs, that incidents come to pass that you have no control over. Then you've got the kal imperfect, third masculine singular of kara, Q-A-R-A-H. This means to come into contact with, to meet, to encounter. Normally it's used of events that are beyond human control. For time and chance overtake, then you have the sign of the direct object here in the Hebrew, just looks like F-E-T-H, and the masculine singular noun construct with the third masculine plural suffix, all of them, literal, of kol, the masculine singular noun there. This happens, time and chance overtake all of them. Moreover, man does not know his time. Moreover, here is the conjunction key with, coupled with the adverb gam. It means exactly that. The gam signifies an addition, also, moreover, additionally, with an added sense of a causal sort of explanation. Here, man does not know, negative lo plus the cal imperfect third masculine singular of yada, the verb to know, recognize. This verb is used in a lot of ways. Does not recognize, and this, recognize might be the better one here. Man does not recognize certain things about his time and history. Certain things come upon mankind when they least expect it. And Solomon had seen this often enough to know that it does happen. The man, through here, consistently, pretty much, he doesn't do it all the time, but I think it's probably 90% or more. You got the definite article plus the word Adam, A-D-H-A-M, to refer to mankind in general, the man. Mankind, we might even say no man, but in this case it's a more general term for all mankind, that certain segments of society in certain generations find themselves in certain situations for which they're woefully unprepared. Mankind does not know his time. His time is the masculine singular noun of F. We'll actually have the sign of the direct object, what he does not know. His time is the masculine singular noun of F plus the third masculine singular suffix, his time. Its time, literally, because we're talking about mankind at large. And in this context, it has to be a bad time, that certain horrible things happen to mankind for which they really aren't prepared. Their experiences won't help them. And he explains this in terms of fish being caught in a treacherous net. Well, for a fish, is there any other kind of net? If it catches you, you're done. And birds trapped in a snare. So the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Like fish caught in a treacherous net. You've got the inseparable preposition ka, which is just a K in the Hebrew. And then the word dag, D-A-G-H. That word means fish. And in fact, the Philistine fish god was called Dagon, which just add another guttural or another letter there to the end of it, and you'll have that word, the noon. So, like fish, which you have the prefix relative particle sheen, which is a shortened form of asher that is attached to the niphal participle, masculine plural, of akaz. A-C-H-A-Z. To be caught, seized, or taken. Again, the passive indicates an outside agent. In a net, the word matsod, metsod actually here, M-E-T-S-O-D-H-A-H. That is metsoda, actually. Two times, and that word means a net. And then you have it qualified by the feminine singular adjective of ra'ah, evil. And in this case, it's not a moral evil. Clearly, you would not attribute a moral quality to a net. It is a dangerous net for the fish. It's dangerous only to the fish, in fact. The net doesn't hurt the guy throwing it. So, like fish caught in a treacherous net. And wow, like a bird. You got the inseparable preposition kaf, which is often used to set up comparisons in the Hebrew. Then this word, Tsifur, T-S-I-P-H-O-R. That's an H there, P-H-O-R. That word means exactly that, a bird. Then you have the definite article here with the cal passive participle, the one being caught or the one being seized. You have ahaz again. That should be akaz. I'm sorry, I think I transliterated that wrong. That's akaz. Being caught in a snare. The word pack means a snare or a trap, P-A-C-H, with the inseparable preposition bait. Like birds, a trap, and they translated this as a plural, but it's like a bird trapped in a snare. He's individualizing it, but we know that this happens, you know, on repeated occasions, that fish are caught in nets, birds are caught in snares, the snare of the fowler. Like fish and birds, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it falls upon them. This part of the verse leads off with, them, the inseparable preposition kaf plus the third masculine suffix, which refers back to fish and birds. Like fish and birds are trapped, so the sons of men are trapped. So a bird being seized in a trap, like them being trapped or snared, you have the pu'al participle, masculine plural of yakash. Y-A-Q-A-S-H. Eight times this word means to set a trap, to lay a snare. The pu'al is the intensive passive, which signifies complete trapping, completely snared, no hope of escape kind of thing, is the idea here. One might suggest that a bird or an animal could be caught in a trap and somehow manage to make an escape. The pu'al participle here, the intensive passive, indicates that they're completely trapped. They're completely caught up in this, and they can't get away. The sons of men, masculine plural noun construct of ben, plus the definite article, plus the masculine singular noun, mankind, with Adam again. The sons of mankind, the sons of men. For a time. They've translated here at a time. The inseparable preposition lamed generally means two or four, and then you've got the common singular noun eth again. For an evil time, feminine singular noun of ra'ah, and again I would translate this here, a dangerous time, a treacherous time, a distressing time. Just as it would be dangerous and distressing for the animal to be caught in their snare, so mankind is caught in snares for which they are unprepared. When it suddenly falls upon them. You have here the inseparable preposition kaf now, like which, literally, if you want to literalize this, the prefix relative particle sheen, and then the cal imperfect of nafail. N-A-P-H-A-L. The cal imperfect third feminine singular, which will fall upon them suddenly. Upon them is the preposition ale. and then the third masculine plural suffix. Followed, the last word here is pithon. P-I-T-H apostrophe O-N. 25 times this word is used suddenly, surprisingly. And almost all the usages are in a context of disaster or judgment for which the person was unprepared. So rereading these here in verse 11, I saw again under the sun, the race is not to the fastest, the battle is not to the best warrior, neither is bread to the wise man, nor wealth to the discerning, nor success to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time, when it suddenly falls upon them. Evil in the context, again, meaning dangerous. So point one, as he has done before, Solomon provides one point of view about the realities in life, and then counters that view with another reality that he has observed. Two, Solomon's emphasis in chapter 9, verses 2 through 6, was on the fact that the righteous person, whose deeds are in the hand of God, does not appear to have any advantage over the wicked person under the sun. Three, therefore, he counsels believers to make the most of life by seizing the present opportunities and enjoying the blessings that are provided by the hand of God. Some people don't seem to have a capacity to do this for whatever reason. Whether it's lack of doctrine, failure to apply the doctrine, we don't know. But sometimes people don't seem to have the opportunity or the ability to just seize the present moment and enjoy it. They are trying to do whatever it is they're trying to do. Maybe they're trying to manipulate the future. Well, that certainly takes the enjoyment out of the present moment if you're busy trying to manipulate the future. So four here in verse 10, he has counseled against a life that is characterized by inactivity, since death will put an end to all human activity under the sun. And throughout this book, as we're going to see if you look a little bit further ahead in chapter 10, he denigrates those people who do not use good sense and do what needs to be done. In verse 18 of chapter 10, through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. So clearly those people who do not take care of basic maintenance are going to run into problems. Chapter 11, divide your portion, verse 2, to 7 or 8, for you do not know what misfortune will fall on, may occur on the earth. And verse 6, sow your seed in the morning, do not be idle in the evening. So throughout all this, even though Solomon acknowledges certain things happen, certain things are beyond our control, we really don't know the future, we can't control it. He doesn't say, well, then just sit there and wait and see what happens. He always counsels activity. And that is, to me, important because people sometimes will use this as an excuse not to do anything, if such is the manner of life. And it is on some occasions. Then I just won't do anything. I will just sit and wait and see what happens. That is one approach to life. Solomon doesn't counsel that approach to life, but that is one approach. Five, however, Solomon now proceeds to inform the believer that in spite of all his good efforts, the outcome of certain events is not fully within his control. And it doesn't make any difference at a certain level how smart you are, how brilliant, how well laid your plan. There's a certain aspect to this that there's a mystery about the future that we don't know. And you can't always be guaranteed success no matter how smart you are. Again, the best laid plans of mice and men. Six, in verses 9, 11 through 10, 14, Solomon emphasizes the fact that the wise cannot be any more sure of his or her earthly future than the fool. Seven, one can be certain that Solomon has observed enough during his lifetime to be qualified to comment on the righteous and the wicked, as well as being qualified to comment on the wise and the foolish. He has cataloged a myriad of examples of these types of people and their behaviors. He has observed this. He has been a student of human nature and observed people, saw how they were, how they operated, how they conducted themselves, the outcome of their various endeavors as he did all this, and comes to the point where he just says, look, at a certain level, there is a mystery to this that we can't penetrate. We don't know what God is always doing. In fact, very often, we don't know what God is doing at all, because unless he reveals it to you. And that fits very well with what we know of 1 Corinthians 2. If God is, no man knows the thoughts of a man except the man, the spirit of a man which is in him. Even so, nobody knows the thoughts of God unless he reveals them through his spirit, because only the spirit of God knows these things. So unless God reveals himself, there are certain things we just don't know. And we never are going to know. And you have to just accept that limitation. 8, Solomon begins his reflections on this aspect of life by using the verb shuv, to turn or return, which acts as a dependent of an auxiliary verb, whose function is to repeat the action of the second verb. So 9, in that regard, it is sometimes translated by the word again, as it is here, I turned again, or I looked again, rather, is how I think he translates this. I again saw, is the way the New American Standard deals with it. But the main verb, again, is the kal, perfect, of shuv, and the infinitive is dependent upon that, the infinitive construct. So 10, this is the 27th of the 29 times that Solomon uses the phrase under the sun, which is designed to describe the stage on which all these types of things occur. Again, the sun being that which illuminates, that which provides light. How do we know what the human experience is like? We see it under the sun. The sun illuminates what our experiences are like. We can observe them, watch them, catalog them if you chose to. Solomon did. And that just gets to the point where, okay, now we've seen all this. Life under the sun is what it is. You can't change it. You can't modify it. At some levels, you can't. It is what it is. And this is the stage on which all these events come to pass, which is the stage of life, essentially. 11, his advice in verse 10 might tend to suggest that hard work, grit, and determination might be sufficient. One should throw himself into his endeavors and seemingly expect success. That is sort of the general view of what verse 10 might be getting at, his advice here. If you find something to do, do it with all your might, because you're going to die. And while he never comes out and says, and I guarantee you'll be successful, the implication is that that's the only way you're going to be successful. You're only going to be successful if you do these things. So he tells his audience, okay, look, whatever your hand finds to do, do it. And so, but will this guarantee me success, Solomon? No. Well, bummer. Now, I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to hear that if I just did right, had wisdom, functioned as far as I know in harmony with God's plan, that I would be okay. No guarantees. There aren't any guarantees. And that's why, again, he immediately moves to counter his one point of view with this point of view, his own devil's advocate. 12, in fact, this is consistent with what traditional wisdom taught with respect to achieving success in areas that corresponded to one's area of expertise and the amount of diligence he applied to the endeavor. Proverbs 10:4. One might naturally suspect, okay, I've got skills. If I use these skills in a sound way, I should expect success. Solomon says, well, no, not necessarily. You might. But traditional wisdom said you should. You should expect success. A poor is he who works with a negligent hand. But the hand of the diligent makes rich. And Solomon, now, and of course Solomon wrote this proverb, as well as what he's writing in Ecclesiastes. And if you pit Solomon's writings against one another, the Solomon of Ecclesiastes would say, oh, hold on, not necessarily. This is generally viewed as the rule, but there are exceptions to the rule. The hand of the diligent, does it always make rich? Not according to Ecclesiastes, it doesn't. And it doesn't, well, we see in life that it doesn't. It's not always the diligent person that gets blessed. Sometimes the actual slug can just sit there and be a slug and may come into the same sorts of blessings and all that that the diligent person gets. Just he's in the right place at the right time. That's another whole thing that Solomon does acknowledge at some point in this book. And that is certain things happen and you just have to be in the right place at the right time. And if you are, boom, you got the blessing. And it's not always because you're fast or smart or anything else. That's the whole idea of certain circumstances come to pass over which we have no control. And if a person's in the right place at the right time, and we've seen this happen in life before, people can just be in the right place at the right time, come up with the right idea at the right time in history, and suddenly, man, they're filthy rich. Everything just goes their way. Well, Proverbs 10:4, also Proverbs 12:24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. Is that always true? No, not necessarily. This is the norm for what we expect in life, that the hardworking person will get ahead, will probably climb the ladder in terms of success in some ways, and may even be put in a position of authority because of their diligence. And generally speaking, we would expect lazy people to not prosper in this world. Ultimately, since they have no get up and go, no self-motivation, then ultimately they're going to end up being slaves of someone else because they have no desire. And typically, this is the way the world works. 21:5 also is the last one here in Proverbs. The plans of the diligent surely lead to advantage, but everyone who is hasty surely comes to poverty. And typically speaking, again, a generalization we would say is that people who don't stop and think through things ultimately will not be successful. Generally speaking, they're not. Now, is there that one exception out there, that idiot that doesn't bother thinking ahead, doesn't worry about it, and just blunders right through and boom, he's successful? Yes, that happens in life. But that is not the general way wisdom goes. That is not the general way diligence goes. So everyone who is hasty, people who are quick to jump to decisions, don't think through things, all that. There's a time and a place. So recognize again, you don't always have time to think through everything. This is where doctrine becomes invaluable because you're thrust into circumstances where you have to act in the moment. And you don't have time to stop and pray about it for a week. So, well, if I can't pray about it for a week, I'm not doing it. Well, good luck in life then. Good luck dealing with those unexpected things that you can't stop and pray about. Matthew 25:15. And this is in the parable of the talents, where the homeowner, in this case, obviously analogous to the Lord, provides certain talents, and talents here in the sense of money. This was not just mental or physical talents, but talents in the sense of money. He gave them X amount of money to do business with while he was gone, and he entrusted his possessions to them. To one, he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. And so one might expect, okay, well, the guy given the most would probably, likely, one would expect, was the most trusted by the landowner and would be the most successful. And in this case, it proves true. This kind of vindicates the wisdom approach to things, that the landowner is a smart man and he provided his slaves with things according to their own ability. Now, did they go out and did they use these things according to their ability and were they blessed in them? Well, all except one of them did. Immediately, the one who had received 5 talents went out and traded with them and gained 5 more talents. He's being a good steward of what his master has entrusted to him. So he exercises under stewardship, recognizing it's not his money. It's his master's, and his job is to be a servant that prospers his master in that regard as much as he can to aid his master. The same manner, one who had received 2 talents gained 2 more. And this goes kind of along the lines of what we might expect from traditional wisdom. That people who have X amount of talent can achieve certain things, as it were, and succeed in certain areas. But he who received 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Not very smart, even from a practical perspective. Why would you bury money in the ground? That's just dumb. Most people, you know, there's people that do that though, right? Go out there in their coffee cans and, you know, buried in the backyard, about 1 million of them, each with $1.15 in it. Well, why people do that, that doesn't make very much sense from a human perspective even, let alone a doctrinal or a wisdom perspective. And he hid his master's money. Well, this doesn't work out for him, as we might expect that it does not. And so this passage here kind of goes along the lines of traditional wisdom, that it does work out, in some cases, the way we would expect it to. It doesn't always work out that way. But this one shows that in some cases it does. Well, 13, however, he now counters with a series of examples that make it painfully obvious that things in life do not always go the way that one would normally expect them to go. 14, he cites five different categories of humanity that one would normally expect might be successful in their endeavors. However, he proceeds to document from his experience that what might be expected does not always come to pass. And that's the nature of God's plan. That is part of the mystery of God's plan. We saw it in the book of Daniel. We did that book for some of you who were here. But in Daniel, one of the things we saw was Daniel recognized this and acknowledged that God was not dependent upon human wisdom, human IQ, human intellect, and all of that in order to accomplish his plan. And in Daniel chapter 2, if you turn there, and in that regard, since God is not dependent upon human achievement, human intellect, human IQ, all these things, therefore his plan may not always proceed the way people think it might, or should even. And then they have issues with God. Why? Because they have this preconceived notion that God must do it one way, and yet he doesn't always do it that way. And in Daniel chapter 2, he talks about the nature of God, and the fact, he says, let the name, verse 20, of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. And he knows what's in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you, O God of my fathers. I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. And even now you have surely made known to me what we requested of you. And at a later point, Daniel talks about, in this book, and I can't remember right where it's at now, but he talks about the fact that God's plan, he exalts even the lowliest men over his plan. Because he's not dependent upon all the normal human things that people might expect. And so God's plan continues to advance, and many times, unfortunately, in ways that we may not expect, we may not always figure out. Phil 15, these five examples are not meant to be exhaustive of the human experience. However, they serve as good examples that a system of human merit alone does not always bring about the desired or expected outcome. 16, he expresses the five situations in a grammatically identical way. He uses the inseparable prefix lamed here to denote the category or person in view, and follows that with the endeavor in which the person would normally be expected to succeed. And so reading this on the surface, it's pretty evident what he's doing here. Fast people win races. Big bad warriors win battles. Wise men, they succeed in life and are prospered and all that. Discerning people, well, because they're shrewd, they can play the stock market, they see forces and things that act and all of this, and they accumulate wealth. And people with great abilities often succeed, as we would expect them to, in the area of their endeavor. Well, 17, the first type of person that Solomon acknowledges in this world is the swift, who would normally be expected to excel, where there was a test of speed. 18, while some have debated as to the exact emphasis here, there is no need to limit this to the running in war. I mean, sometimes you'll be astonished at what interpreters will spend their time discussing.
Well, what kind of running do you think he has in view here?
I think it's general. I think it's any kind of running. I think where one expects speed to carry the day, it doesn't matter what kind of running he's doing. But, they'll spend entire paragraphs in these commentaries talking about it. Well, 1 Samuel 18:11 does deal with the fact, and I understand why they do it. There is different types of running set forth in the scripture. So he's aware of this. 1 Samuel 18:11. Well, that's clearly not the right verse. There was one in here about the running in war, and I've got the wrong verse here. And it was in, maybe it's 2 Samuel, because... Nope, that's not it. Well, there's one in here. Trust me, there is a deal here about a guy running. And it's in a context of warfare, and they sent certain messengers out in the context of warfare to deliver messages and all of that. I'm sorry, it's 8:11. I got a 1 in there. That's the problem. It's 8:11. 1 Samuel 8:11. And this is a perfect example. I don't care how much Greek, Hebrew, systematic, isagogics you know. You can't get the verse right. It doesn't matter. 8:11. This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen. And they will run before his chariots. In this case, running into battle. But they also had deals where they would run to deliver messages and certain things. And this was considered an area of honor. Well, there's running in athletic competition, as we might expect. 1 Corinthians 9:24, where Paul uses that athletic analogy. Those who run in a race all run. And I can't remember who it was. It was years and years ago. I saw it was this comedian, you know, and he's kind of pretending he's running, you know, he's running along. He said, can you imagine what that guy that's finishing last in the Olympics thought? You know, he's in the steep, you know, the marathon or whatever, and he's coming in last place. Well, shoot, I didn't even have to train to finish last. Why did I even bother? Well, at that point, of course, all your training was worthless. You finished last. I mean, you got to be in the Olympics, and of course, in our modern-day feel-good society, that would be a good thing. Well, you got to compete, and that's what's important. The fact that you finished dead last. Don't let it bother you. Well, it bothers me. I didn't want to finish last. Kind of humiliating, you know. You know, the cameras are still there rolling. Well, there he is. He's still bringing up the end, the rear. This man is no athlete. It's obvious. You know, the comments that they could make and all of that. Or running here as a courier on behalf of some official. Let's hope 2 Samuel 18:19 is right. You never know. Yes, okay, this one's right. Good. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hands of his enemy. But Joab said to him, you are not the man to carry news this day. You will carry news another day. However, you shall carry no news today because the king's son is dead. So 19, and again, there is no need to complicate this. In the type of situation where speed becomes important, we normally expect the fastest man to win. 20, however, there are a number of things that may prevent the fastest runner from winning the race. These include injury, a cheating opponent, unforeseen circumstances, carelessness, lack of stamina, and even lack of preparation. I'm the fastest guy in the world. Man, I wish I had not have done 19 shots of tequila before the race. That will probably do you in, you know, the night before. You get up, he's out there on the track puking in the morning. I don't care how fast you are, you won't win, probably. That day is not going to be your day. So you can do it, you can do yourself in through your own stupidity. Certain things can come to pass that you can't explain. You might have an opponent that trips you. Oh, that's happened before. I mean, I've seen that in distance races. Opponent accident, whether it's intentional or not, even an accidental trip. You fall on the track, and, you know, if you're running 400 meters, you don't have time to get up and regroup. You're done. That's it. Well, again, a number of things could happen. And 21, his second example focuses on the elite, seasoned, and powerful warrior who would normally be expected to excel in the rigors of a battle or war. And in that regard, the battle, well, and I think I actually skipped that when I was doing the exegesis here. I didn't give you that word. It's milkamah in the Hebrew there. The definite article, and that means a battle, a war, or warfare, kind of depending upon the situation. Whether it's a whole war or just an individual battle within the war. Well, 22, however, it does not always experience brute force or fearlessness, or the proper weapons that bring success to any warrior. There is a certain amount of understanding, strategy, and bravery that negates physical prowess alone. 1 Samuel 17:23-50. And in this regard, we see the proof of what Solomon speaks of here. We can cite you an example of which Solomon would have been aware and may even had in mind when he wrote these words. 1 Samuel 23, as he was talking with them, behold, the champion, Goliath, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming upon the army of the Philistines. And he spoke these words, and David heard them. And when all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. Well, he's 9'6". Want to fight? No. 6 foot, suddenly you're like a grasshopper in your own sight. You're 6 foot tall. And suddenly, no. Got 3.5 feet on me. And I'm assuming he was proportionately built. He wasn't just tall. He was very strong. That is seen in, if you'd read the whole account, and I didn't read all the things that they say about him here, but he was exceedingly strong. Seemed like the if I remember right, the head on his spear was like 3 or 4 pounds or something. And he could throw this thing and, you know, kill a gnat at 50 yards. So he's strong, he's skilled, he's big, he's powerful. He's been in battle before. He's probably killed hundreds of men already by this time. And he knows no fear. No fear of God, anyway, that's for sure. And probably no fear at all. The men of Israel said, have you seen this man coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches. Translated, the king is not going to fight him. But he wants somebody to. And he wants somebody to kill him. Who kills him and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by, saying, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? See, David looks at this from doctrine and says, hey, look, he isn't just out here running his mouth. He's bad-mouthing our God and God's people. And the people answered him in accord with what was saying. This will be it. And Eliab, his oldest brother, when he heard of, he spoke to the man, Eliab's anger burned against David. He said, "What? Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." But David said, "What have I done now? Was it not just a question?" Can't even ask a question around here. Well, his brother was agitated clearly with David to start with the fact that he was even there. Didn't even like it. Because he knows the will of God for everybody, obviously. This guy's as arrogant too. He's got his own problems. And David said, what have I done? Was it just a question? He turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told him to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said, essentially, let no man's heart fail on account of him. I know all your people are scared. Everybody's scared out there. They're all shaking in their boots. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You are but a youth. And he has been a warrior from his youth. I mean, he was trained, just like, you know, that elite group of Greek soldiers there, the 300 that withstood them, withstood the Persian army, the mass of the Persian army at the Battle of Thermopylae. And wisdom enabled that army of 300 men. But they were awesome fighting machines too. They were bred for it from the day practically of their birth, from a very young age. And they were exceedingly skilled and knew no fear. But they withstood literally an army hundreds and thousands of times bigger than them. And guess what? It can happen. Well, David explains to him, look, I've been out watching sheep. Well, of course you're qualified to fight. What was I thinking? But he explains to him, when a lion or bear came out and took him, I went out against him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David's motivation is correct in this, because he's got God's honor in mind. God's honor is being besmirched by this uncircumcised Philistine out there running his mouth. And the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me. So Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk. That's right, the army's too heavy. I'm not going to be able to make this, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. And he took his, and by the way, he never wore any armor when he was fighting the bear and the lion either. He was out there just as he was going to go out against this Philistine. And he took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. In verse 42, when the Philistine looked at him, when he comes, by the way, the shield bearer is in front of the Philistine. The shield bearer was a pretty impressive specimen as well. But he was there to protect the Philistine. So David's literally going out against two of them. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. For he was but a youth and a redhead, with a handsome appearance. And, you know, typical coloring of people, you know, that have red hair. And you're probably the freckles and all that. And here's this little freckle-faced brat, as the Philistine sees it, coming out against him. Well, this is an insult. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine also said, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. And David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of the armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the armies of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky. Little words from a big words from a guy standing there 5'6". You know, red hair, youthful. All these things. Unimpressive to the maximum. No weapons. No shield. No spear. Well, how are you going to kill me? So that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel. And David wasn't doing it for his own glory. See, he had all this right. David was humble. David recognized that God's virtue was being taunted out here in front of everybody. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came near to meet David. Now you got to admit, he's probably getting angrier and angrier as he's hearing all this. As he's standing there, first he feels insulted that David's even there. Then when he hears this speech, he's like, okay, it's time to dispatch you. I've had enough of this. David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine, put his hand in his bag, took out a stone and slung it, struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Not your typical, you know, military weapons that you would go out with. And there was no sword in David's hands. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his own sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut his head off with it. Just like he told him I was going to do. It's no brag, just fact. And he did it. If you can back it up, it's not bragging. And David did it. Why? Well, again, the battle didn't go to the greatest warrior that day. Or maybe it did. Maybe the greatest warrior wasn't what people thought. Well, 23, while the first two examples focused on the physical realm and the physical prowess that one would expect to bring success, the last three examples deal with the mental realm and deals with those that have wisdom, discernment, and knowledge. 24, the third example focuses on that of the wise man, who according to traditional wisdom would be blessed with physical provisions. Proverbs 21:20. And again, very often David is simply challenging or conventional wisdom or pointing out that even conventional wisdom has its limitations and it's not always true. Does not mean it's not true 95 times out of 100. It just means there's those 5 times where it's not. Proverbs 21:20, there is precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise. One expects the wise man to be blessed with a certain amount of physical things because his wisdom is going to provide this for him. Additionally, point 25, one would expect that the wise man would be smart enough to make all the necessary provisions so he could provide for his own physical needs. 26, again, many factors may come into play that would negate the wisdom of the wise, not the least of which is God himself. Clearly, God can intervene in ways that we may not even understand. For instance, Isaiah 29:14 is one of those. Therefore, I will once again deal marvelously with this people, wondrously marvelous. And the wisdom of their wise men will perish, and the discernment of their discerning men will be concealed. Woe to those who deeply hide their plans from the Lord, whose deeds are done in a dark place. And they say, who sees us or who knows us? Well, God can see in the darkness. And he can undermine whatever wisdom they think they have. Further, wise men and sages were not always recompensed according to their relative value. That we see first in our verse here, 9:15, but in 2:16 he's also alluded to this, that this was what he bemoaned, in fact, was that it didn't always come the way we might expect it to come. One might expect that the wise man would have a greater legacy than the fool. There is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. So one might normally expect, well, okay, the wise man, he's going to be remembered. He's not remembered. That's the whole point. In fact, he's going to reinforce that if you look ahead in the rest of the chapter, chapter 9. Later in chapter 9, he's going to reinforce this with the fact that a story that serves to prove his point here. There was a great city, verse 14, with a few men in it, and a great king came to it and surrounded it and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. They're going to build a statue for him, right? They're going to remember him forever because he delivered all these people from what they were facing, which was annihilation at that point. So he remembered, yet no one remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the wisdom of the poor man is despised and his words are not heeded in some cases. Now in this case, they were heeded. The city was delivered. But the reality is, nobody remembered. Who won the Super Bowl last year? You might remember that one. It was a big one. Who won it the year before, though? Who won the British Open 5 years ago? Who has made the greatest sacrifices for their country? Some men, their legacy does live on after them. We know that. People still know who Benjamin Franklin is and still know who John Adams is and George Washington and Thomas Paine and all of that. But during their time in history, were they deemed to be great, important guys who, you know, at some level they had some, we know, they had some wherewithal and they had some experience and they had some effect on people. But the very next generation after them, how quick did they forget them? And it was probably pretty fast, as it would be in almost all generations. So he's going to point out that, again, things don't always go, and even a wise man is not necessarily going to be recompensed according to his relative value. And that's the 9:15 there, and 2:16 also as well. And guess what? One would think, again, this guy delivers the city. I would think he would be golden for the rest of his life. Wouldn't you think so? Nope. Not at all. Doesn't make any difference. 27, the next category, which one might expect to meet with success, but who is not necessarily favored with success, is the discerning. 28, the verb being, discerning, denotes the understanding or insight that allows one to distinguish between one thing and another. 29, the verb refers to knowledge that is viewed as superior to the mere gathering of facts or data. It becomes necessary to know how to use the knowledge one possesses. So people can have what we would call a lot of book smarts. They could study certain things out, know a lot of things about a lot of disciplines, and be very knowledgeable about them. But if they don't know how to put that knowledge into action, if they can't distinguish as to when they ought to even put it into action, then they effectively become useless, no matter how much they know. And certain people become useless, even though they are very knowledgeable about a lot of things. Their knowledge is undermined by the fact that they aren't discerning enough to know how to use that knowledge. So 30, in that regard, the discerning person would be expected to understand the nature of things. The discerning person can see the difference between one thing and another, and he can see it clearly. That's the point. To understand the nature of things and people, how to relate to those things and people, and how to navigate his way through life in a successful fashion. Proverbs 2:9. One would expect that this is the nature of wisdom, and it is, that this would always be true. Well, it's not always true. That's the problem. We have to acknowledge that certain exceptions exist. And actually, before we go to 2:9, just turn back to Proverbs 1 for the purpose of wisdom, or the purpose actually in writing the book. Proverbs 1, the Proverbs of Solomon, are written here for the purpose of knowing wisdom and instruction, for the purpose of discerning the sayings of understanding, for the purpose of receiving instruction in wise behavior, which includes righteousness, justice, and equity, to give to the prudence to the naive, to the unlearned, and to the youth knowledge and discretion. But discernment is a part of thing, as a natural fallout, we might say, from pursuing wisdom. And then chapter 2, verse 9, then you will discern righteousness and justice, and equity and every good course. For wisdom will enter your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. And then 10:13, so it says essentially, if you pursue wisdom and you get some discernment, you can be counted on to figure things out. Ah, but can you always? That becomes the rub. You can't. On the lips of the discerning, wisdom is found. But a rod is for the back of him who lacks understanding. So 31, because a discerning man is prudent in his actions. He watches things carefully and often does not fall prey to the misfortunes of the foolish. But Solomon is going to say, but sometimes he does. Sometimes all his discernment doesn't help him. The naive believes everything. The discerning person is not naive. They don't believe everything. They see things, they see that there are differences, and they don't just embrace everything equally. Verse 15, the naive believes everything, but the sensible man considers his steps. A wise man is cautious and turns away from evil. He discerns the difference out there between one thing and another, and he sees that certain paths, certain people, certain courses of action are not the best choice. And his discernment tells him this. Well, one would think if he was truly discerning that he would make the right decision at every turn. But even the truly discerning don't always make the right decision, and things occur to them that they are not prepared for. All right, our time is up. We will stop there today and continue on here Wednesday evening. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to assemble together, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of God. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.